This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Everybody, welcome back to the show. For people who are listening on the podcast, this is the VPZD show. I'm ZDog MD, Dr. Zubin Damania. This is Dr. Vinay Prasad.
It's good to be back. It's good to be in person.
In person. And we are
face to face,
maskless in Seattle, but we're in the Bay. And what's cool is, so people who watch, who listen only to the podcast, they can click a link in the description and it'll take them to the YouTube video.
They want to see our smiling faces.
You know
don't
what?
They?
We're so attractive too. That's the other thing. We were just, both you and me, were just sharing stories about how we've lost like random weight just by not eating out.
Well, yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
It's kind of crazy, but I don't know. Is it a good thing? Yeah. Feel better.
I feel better. Yeah, I mean, it's better. It's an easier way to lose weight than getting a malignancy.
Hey, listen. Hey, with the way inflation is, you got to eat at home. I mean, you can't afford to eat out
anymore.
It's
really true. Yeah. But even eating at home, you like look at the bread prices. Remember when George H.W. Bush during the campaign for re-election in 91 against Clinton couldn't name like how much a loaf of bread cost?
I remember. And what about Dr. Oz and his little vegetable plate?
Oh, that was great. The crudité.
The crudité. We all have all the time, obviously. I mean, crudité.
My wife was making a crudité. Can you believe it was $20? And that's before the tequila.
But it's funny. This inflation is linked to COVID-19, don't you think? Because this is something that I think John Ioannidis kind of hinted at the original stat op-ed, which was that all these restrictions were placing and the injection of capital into the market. Mm-hmm. So like the Biden stimulus was probably an overshoot, which is what Larry Summers and others say, right. That has led to inflation. People have hoarded their money. They've had an injection of capital. They've been all this business bailout, buyback bullshit. And now there's a flood of capital and it's leading to runaway inflation.
Absolutely. And the thing is, people think that just printing money is like, oh, that's just free money for me.
Yeah.
That's not how that works.
That's like what that Epi 101 was, just stay at home and we'll give you checks. And it's like, I think that's not Epi 101. That's Econ 101. And you blundered
and you
one.
Failed it.
You blundered
right.
it. Yeah.
Well, so
yeah.
It's funny. So like both you and I have done a couple talks recently, which is nice because the speaking thing, now people are willing to have conferences.
It's good to be back there on stage, isn't it?
It's amazing, actually. At first, I'll be honest, I had started having panic attacks because it's been so long.
And you no longer wear pants.
So and I don't
big,
wear pants.
Yeah, so that's
I mean, I'm not
off-putting.
Wearing them now. I won't wear them in the future. Yeah. It's a hill I'm willing to die on.
It's the Zoom legacy.
It yeah. is. Yeah. It's a legacy of the being pantless while talking. In fact, I don't think I can talk with the constriction around my waist. You know, my 32 waist or whatever it is. But
you're giving a talk.
So
you like it up there?
So I gotta say, at first I was terrified because I'm also unable to be inauthentic in any way anymore. There's something has clicked in my head where it's like, life is short.
You always want to be yourself.
I just want to be myself. And after all this like meditation and all this bullshit, it's almost like stabbing myself to try to put on an act that isn't actually what I'm feeling in that moment. So I was like, this is gonna be. But what I found was, wow, people are like desperate for the in-person juice, like the vibe of being together. They're seeing each other. So the one I did just the other day was right here in San Francisco. And it was a big multi-specialty medical group, 500 docs.
Doctors.
And it was last minute. They were like, could you come? And we're doing a thing that we have not seen each other face-to-face like this in 3 years without masks. We have not. And this is the first event. We just want to have fun and we want to do this thing, but we want to inspire people. So on. So I'm like, okay, great. So I came with no slides. I was just like, I'll just talk off the cuff. It'll be great. And the room was set up in this very long way, 500 people, spouses, and they started drinking the minute they hit the thing.
They were ready to go.
They were fired up. These are like in COVIDian central geography, right? Like these are people who they're walking the walk. They're wearing N95s, you know, to work and they're doing all of that.
I see.
And so, but
not at the conference.
Not at the conference.
Yeah,
at the conference,
yeah.
Everybody, and my buddy who is in that organization was telling me, he's like, wow, I haven't seen faces like this in 3 years. And so the minute I walked in and I see the cocktail hour starting and people starting to hang out and if some people are recognizing me and stuff, I'm like, this talk is going to be irrelevant because they're not going to be listening to it.
I see.
They're going to be at these round, big conference tables talking to each other. So whatever I say, it doesn't even matter. So my stage fright went away.
Okay.
And I went up and I just made a bunch of jokes. And the people within the range of my voice that could see me directly, where there was social capital in paying attention, they were paying attention and laughing. Everybody anywhere down the line in this long rectangular room, they were just talking to each other and yucking it up. It was so loud, I couldn't hear myself on stage.
Even when you were talking?
Even when I was
talking.
And I thought, oh, I would have thought, oh, maybe it's me. No, no, no. The leaders of the org who were speaking before and after, you couldn't even hear them.
I see. These people were so excited to see each other.
They were so excited.
Yeah.
Now, you would have caught me 5 years ago and I would have done a thing at an audience and that would have happened to me. I would have taken it deeply personally.
Sure.
I've been like, I'm an incompetent speaker. I can't command their attention and so on and so on. Here I was like, I even said it. I go, you guys, this is so awesome to see. Like, look at people who haven't seen each other without a mask, who are drinking, who are having fun, who are reengaging as humans. Like, this is what's going to transform the organization.
And they weren't pulling up the mask between sips.
in the heart, it was like the Lothlorien of Elvendom, like right the Covidian Central, San Francisco.
Yeah, it's like Las Vegas in the heart of the Vatican.
That's right, exactly right. That's what it was like. It was like debauchery, right in the middle of the temple.
So interesting, you know. And I had a similar experience. I gave a lecture recently to a healthcare professional audience, and we were talking maybe 1,000 people in a room, and it was packed. But what was different was they weren't seated in a way they could talk to each other. They were seated all, you know, all eyes on stage. And I could tell, you know, obviously, I have a little bit of jokes, not, it wasn't a full comedy set.
Because you actually have science involved.
I tried to, but you know, to be honest, the science was a dud. Ain't nobody want to learn about multiple hypothesis testing and analytic flexibility. Ain't nobody want to learn about that. What they wanted to see was I've collected some of my favorite COVID headlines, you know, and that was crushed.
Oh,
it was crushing.
So
and
good.
You could just tell. Like, you know, the focus was so there and people were looking to laugh. Not a mask in sight, not a mask in sight.
Dude,
know?
It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And you look, you and I are connoisseurs of speaking, right? We love communication.
We take
love
pride in the craft.
That we take pride in the craft. Like we love getting in a flow state and so on. You know, what was crazy about the event I did in San Francisco was flow state was not the issue there because you can't do it. It's too loud. What it was feeling the energy of a crowd that is so pumped to be there. So here's the punchline to this whole story. So I go down
They all got COVID-19.
They all got COVID. It was a super spreader event. Everybody died.
Yeah, of course.
Worse yet, they all got long COVID.
Every last one of them. The brains just shrunk right up.
Shrunk up. And many of them have had COVID 6-7 times.
Of course.
And
that's when you get the maximum brain shrinkage.
It's constant.
It slowly shrinks everything. You know, I hear that. So I keep reading articles saying that COVID does all sorts.
You know, they don't list priapism as a complication of long COVID, but I suffer from it.
I've never
even had documented COVID, but I consider that a long COVID side effect. But what was interesting, I also had shorter of a time to speak than they had planned because the cocktail hour went so long.
Wow.
They couldn't round people up to sit down. Now, so it ends and then there's dancing and dinner and like photo booth and all this kind of fun stuff that they do.
Yeah.
Dude, I was freaking mobbed by people. They weren't even listening to the talk, but they wanted to connect. They were taking selfies. They were like, oh, I love you and VP when you talk all that smack. Like we can't say that stuff on, you know, and.
Yeah, they often say, I agree with you fully, but I'm very hesitant to say that. And
dude, it was awesome. And it made me think you and I need to go on the road as a tag team,
uh-huh.
like off the top rope. Like I tag my boy, VP. He makes some jokes, comes in with some science. I come out, do a little rap.
It would be a great show.
It would be great.
If you're out there listening and you want to see this in a theater near you, you got
to talk to our representation, which is us.
Yeah, which is Z Dog. Actually, email Z.
Yeah, exactly. No, but it did one in Nashville. It was the same thing. Dude, people are just so.
I mean, you're absolutely right in so many fronts. And then one thing I also want to point out is for those people out there who say that there's no downside to masking. I'm sorry, you can see instantly. You learn more about what somebody feels and thinks, and it is a barrier to communication. If it weren't, people would have been doing it for all this time and they don't. Why is the face the most expressive organ, you know, for a reason to communicate lots of how you're feeling? And when you give a talk, I was about to say a swear word, but remember we're trying our best not to. But it was about Zoom. And so I think maybe it would have been warranted.
Zoom. Yeah.
Effing Zoom. And you know, with Zoom, you do not have the same feeling as when you give a talk in person. You are seeing the reactions of everyone. You know
That's
when
right.
you have them, you know when you lost them. I know, for instance, when I got into multiple hypothesis testing, I had lost him.
Yeah.
And I had him when I pulled it back to things that were more practical and concrete and less sort of theoretical.
You feel it.
You feel
it. You feel the flow of energy in that room. Now, here's an interesting thing I just realized.
Well, a good speaker feels it. A bad speaker will just plow
through.
Doesn't even
care. They plow through their slides.
They read the little thing at the bottom of the PowerPoint slide.
Yep.
While the audience contemplates suicide or
worse. Suicide
or
homicide.
Or homicide,
right.
Or the twain. The twain.
Because the dreaded murder-suicide.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is the gold standard these days. So one thing I just realized when you pointed out Zoom, I actually did a trial myself in this talk, because here's how the room was set up. It was oblong like this. In the corners, they couldn't see me physically at all. Like, it was like being in a different room. Mm. But they had monitors, small LCD monitors with low bandwidth and a poor quality feed. They had to watch me through the monitor, and you watch the gradient of attention. The circle around me where the Petri dish can feel the vibe, they were all intent. And in fact, later they told me I couldn't understand why people were so loud. And I told them I could. As it fades out to the sides, they're watching a Zoom talk. They don't feel the energy. They can't hear my voice clearly. It's all reamplified. And it's a totally different.
And they're wondering what they did wrong in life to end up in that seat. Why can't I be in the front row?
Exactly.
But let me tell you something. So after I did this, I came back to the mothership, and I was giving and I was attending some lectures around campus. And I'm in a big auditorium, and there may be 30 people in an auditorium that could easily seat 200. And it's 90% N95. And there's levels of it. There's the person who wears the KF94 over the ears, And then every so often you catch him pulling it down to take a few breaths. I mean, I've seen people do this.
I've seen it.
Older people particularly. Then there's the person who you know ain't screwing around. They're wearing an N95 fitted with the two latex bands over the head, and it's cutting into their cheeks.
Yeah.
And that's someone, I promise you, they ain't drinking anything at that time.
No.
They are going thirsty if they have to.
100%.
Then you've got people like me who's going to comply with the minimum compliance requirement.
Right.
Or actually, I don't even know if there was one, but I felt at some point I feel so
pressured.
I mean, I don't want to be the only person.
It's a cultural thing, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. As much as we like to buck trends, at some point, you know,
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
If everyone is going to wear a Patagonia fleece to work, I'm going to wear a Patagonia.
I'm wearing one. And it's going to say Z-Dog MB on it. It's going to be the bro.
If everyone's going to wear the Patagonia fleece,
totally.
Then, you know, but if everyone's going to wear a suit and tie in New York City, then you're going
to
wear it.
You're going to have to do it.
So when in Rome. Okay, but I was there. And
that's also called reading the crowd.
Reading the crowd.
Yeah,
I mean, you have to know where you are.
That's right. We're social creatures.
And let's say if you feel a tickle in your throat, you better put a lozenge in, because this is a crowd. They don't want to hear you
cough.
They don't want to hear. Many of them have probably had COVID once or twice, but they're still worried about.
They're all multi-boosted.
The longest.
Longest of COVIDs.
But let me tell you. So then on the screen behind the speaker, there were all the people who would have liked to be in there, but they felt for one reason or another that they didn't want to be there. And they showed their Zoom faces on the screen.
Oh, my.
And, you know, you shouldn't be looking like, I mean, I think when people are on Zoom, they say it feels like all eyes are on me. Well, this was one instance where, it's true.
Yeah.
They're all up there and we're watching you do whatever you're doing. And I love the person on Zoom, like on their iPhone. It's like, you know, from iPhone, and they're just walking around and like confused.
That's the best.
Distracting
everyone because there's emotion in the field. Yeah. You know, it's funny because my friend Angelo does meditation retreats virtually, and he says you actually do develop a lot of concentration, but when you watch the recordings of those, there's multiple people, and because you can see their faces, there's always some dude like, with the thing. It's like, dude, you're totally messing my samadhi, my meditative concentration.
He does it meditation on Zoom.
Yeah.
Oh,
and what's interesting is it's more the setting the intention, so everybody comes, and it actually works really well. It's almost like going on a retreat if you take it seriously. But what's interesting is there were a few people at this thing wearing masks, and they were older and so on, and they stuck out like a sore thumb.
At your thing, yeah.
Yeah, my thing.
At my thing, zero. I'm talking 1,000 people, zero. Yeah,
but go on your thing. The sticking out like a sore thumb was almost like, oh, you can actually see by contrast how abnormal it is when it's not necessary to, I mean, maybe for them it was. Maybe they're immunocompromised. Maybe they're worried. Maybe there's something else going on. Or maybe they're conditioned. It doesn't matter. But you could tell. You're like, this is not right. Like, you can't read their face. You can't see what's going on. So just side by side, you can tell what's going
on. I mean, in San Francisco, though, when you see a group of people and some are wearing N95 and some aren't, it's inversely proportional to risk of disease. It's the
youngest
healthiest
people. Yep.
Especially on a public transportation. I see high school kids do it.
Yep.
And listen, I was reading something that says, you know, 2/3 of Americans are immunocompromised. That's not true, actually. I mean, unless you're stretching the definition of immunocompromised to a point where it has no meaning,
right,
then it's true. But if you're actually using a definition that might be useful, it's not true.
It's not true.
And then here's the thing I really come back to, which is that when it comes to immunocompromised people, and of course I know a lot about this because this is my line of work, and I think we ought to do whatever it takes to keep those people very protected. Mm. But I put immunocompromised status in two buckets. There is transient immunocompromised status, people getting rituximab, people who are getting a bone marrow transplant. And if you're undergoing a transient immunocompromised status, I think it absolutely makes sense to do
everything.
Yeah. Stay at home, mm-hmm. get your groceries delivered, mm-hmm. N95. And then there are disease states that are not going to change that may be immunocompromised status. Somebody with, I think some people would say asthma is one of them. I think that's a very, you know, the risk of COVID in somebody who has mild asthma versus somebody who doesn't is actually a very small difference.
Right.
Or somebody who might be taking a little bit of methotrexate or a little bit of infliximab or something right. like that.
Mild stuff.
Yeah. Mild stuff. But something that they're going to be dealing with for the next 30 years.
Right.
So my question for this is, this person and this doctor and this, you know, this question is, some people in that bucket of static, unchanging immunocompromised status are choosing to wear an N95 mask. And my question is, when will you stop?
Right.
Because you're going to have to wear that for the rest of your life.
Yeah,
because
the exposures are never going to end.
And never going to end.
You've normalized it as being a thing. But I'll say this. I think that the culture is already shifting. Like even in here, like, you know, you notice when you go up and down the elevator in my thing now, when people get on, nobody's wearing masks.
I know. And even in this group, like it may be like less than 2% nationally. And we have to think, we're stuck in San Francisco
where we see
a lot.
Right.
But nationally, some of these cities, they confiscate your mask at the gate to the airplane. They take it away from you. You're not allowed to bring it to Houston, Texas.
Anywhere in Texas, right.
No, Texas, you get take your mask
and
out.
And are the outcomes that dramatically different?
No, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, this is why when people in the throes of things were talking about Sweden, it was like, listen, you're basically checking who's at mile marker one first in the marathon.
Yeah.
It's a 24-mile thing. And it's still not done yet.
Right.
But by all accounts, Sweden is, you know, in the middle of the pack. And you can try to cherry pick some comparison. But if what they did was so horrific, they would be standing out like a sore thumb.
Yeah.
They're nowhere near standing out like That's a sore right. thumb. They're in the pack. And so what they did didn't matter that much.
That's right. Now, Biden misspoke about the pandemic is over.
Is the pandemic over?
Yeah.
It's over. Look around. And then he added the caveat, which is that, of course, we're still having problems with COVID and we have to deal with it, but no one's wearing a mask here. People look good. I think that was what he said.
That was actually if you take it completely out of context of everything else this administration has kind of done
correct.
Around COVID. You go, that's correct.
But, you know, maybe Biden himself is not the problem. It's the people he's chosen to empower for the
jobs.
Yeah,
I think you're right.
The Walensky's, the Jaws, the Morthy's,
right.
who are obviously well, completely off.
Prithvi's, or Vivek is my friend.
Oh, one is your friend. Sorry.
Yes.
We'll talk
so
about
I
that.
So I have to recuse myself
okay,
from any discussion.
Okay, we'll omit him, and then we'll add in the other players who are causing trouble. Fauci, who's not part of this administration, but who this administration continues to platform. Why are you platforming him? he's retiring too.
You chose to platform Fauci. We should have a demonstration where we demand a deplatforming of Fauci.
Well,
he deplatformed himself.
He did because I think he's worried about what the House will do to him if the House switches and they'll investigate.
Oh, interesting.
And so I suspect it's probably something like that. But speaking of which, he's also on TV saying some stupid stuff lately.
We'll get to that. That's a good quote.
So Biden himself, I think his political instinct was always right. I've heard many accounts that say he never wanted to mandate vaccines because he knows the average guy from Delaware, they're not going to like a vaccine mandate to work in the industry. He didn't want to do that. But his advisors, a bunch of people who, you know, didn't know any better, told him to do that.
Yeah.
And it blew up in their face because they had an escape variant right after they mandated it, which absolutely takes away the ethical prerequisite and justification to mandate it. And so that blew up in his face. And now I think his gut would say we need to move beyond COVID. But they were all the cast of characters were back on the talk circuit. Mm-hmm.
Saying, the president,
he just was saying in the moment, in the room, around the people he saw, it looked like COVID wasn't playing. Oh, shut up. That's not what he meant. He meant it's over. Forget about it.
That's right. And you know what's interesting is like CDC just reported 2% of eligible adults have gotten the bivalent booster.
Oh, the booster it was so important to lower the regulatory bar. And if we had tested 15 mice, it would have been 7 mice too many.
Right.
And now nobody wants it. Nobody wants it.
We're going to talk about that.
Well, and also the same fact is true for vaccination under 6 years old. They pushed, five and under.
Yeah.
They pushed that. They lowered the bar. They gave so many chances to the companies. Nobody wants that either. I think it's like plateaued at less than 5% still.
Not very high. You know, and Paul, We'll talk about Paul Offit. Okay. Paul and I talked about this even off camera about vaccinating young kids. Mm-hmm. And his take is, and I think it's not an invalid take, but I don't know that it's, you know, based on huge reams of data. But his take was that, listen, we haven't seen the kind of myocarditis and other things in the—
That I think he's 100% right. Yeah. It doesn't have a safety signal.
And, that's right. And what because he's seeing a population enriched in, he says, you know, a good percentage, like even approaching majority of the kids that he sees that
hospitalized
kids with COVID or even not with MIC do not have a lot of really recognizable comorbidities.
Correct.
And so his take was, look, if you can vaccinate that population and it's low risk and you save kids' lives, it's probably worth doing. He doesn't want to mandate it. But so I thought, okay, I get that perspective. But the public is not feeling the need.
They're not feeling the need. And I guess
a lot of these kids have already been infected.
I get Paul's perspective that if you look around Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and you see that the majority of kids hospitalized with COVID-19 have no antecedent risk factors,
right.
It is a strong psychological argument that those are the kids you also need to vaccinate to prevent them from being in the hospital.
Right.
But I think the parents' side of it, or like the on the other side of it, they're seeing that the denominator, which is millions of kids, and
yeah.
then the risk of being hospitalized, which is maybe 1 in 10^6 or 1 in 100,000 kind of ballpark. They're seeing that risk being dropping with Omicron. They're seeing MIS-C decoupling from the infection with Omicron.
Yeah.
And then the other question I had for Paul, which I would, you know, maybe someday you'll ask him, is that the data that the vaccine in that age group lowers the risk of hospitalization, the Singapore study I'm thinking about,
right.
is persuasive for kids who did not have COVID at baseline.
Right.
But is that true for American kids where we're talking about seroprevalence, perhaps 90%+?
That's right. Because Singapore was more like a COVID zero environment.
It was.
Yeah.
And at the time of the study, they have ways they excluded kids who had known COVID.
Right. So yeah, these are good questions. And
Singapore, you can't spit bubble gum on the sidewalk, or I think they may even
cane you. Well, that was a thing that happened in the 80s or 90s.
And if you get COVID, they'll cane you too.
They'll cane you twice.
I don't know, maybe they cane you twice.
You'll get long caning.
it is a long cane.
It's a long cane. Whoosh. That's right. And the pain lasts for decades.
And what was the name of that boy who spray painted the car? Michael?
Yeah, Michael something who got caned.
And Bill Clinton had to like beg from 8 canes to 4 because apparently after six, it's fatal.
Oh, what?
Yeah, there was something about caning, which is like people were like, oh, it's just a whack on the butt. No, it isn't.
No, they hit you hard.
And like after 4, it rips flesh off. And 6, and then it has a fatality rate once you get to, I think some.
You get infected, yeah.
No. Even the you die from the pain.
Oh my gosh.
I think you die from the pain of impact. I'm not an expert on.
Kids now would die after 2. They're so fragile. I'm dying.
They get a participation trophy even for
after half a cane. The cane is just lifted. They're like, what? Oh man,
they'll die after 2.
Well, you know, we were going to talk about your masking piece, but let's go into Offit and then we'll talk about your mask because now we talk about Paul. So Paul did that show with me, and then he did a Wall Street Journal op-ed talking about the bivalent booster. Mm-hmm. And what he did was he reviewed Moderna's recently released data. We're looking clinically at outcomes, infections and hospitalizations of the original monovalent booster versus the new bivalent booster, where you've split that booster into 2 half doses, two pediatric level doses.
2 soft canings.
Caning
two
light.
Light caning.
Caning light.
Yeah.
And what they found was actually the bivalent booster group did worse clinically.
It looked like it underperformed.
More infections,
now,
more
Now, of course, not the primary endpoint of the
That's
study.
Right.
Low sample size,
That's
all
right.
the appropriate caveats.
Many caveats, yeah.
But Paul's point was that it was not blatantly obvious that it is a better choice.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, I don't know even where to start. There's so many things problematic with this booster idea. One is, and this is what Paul does a great job of separating. One is, what is the evidence? How many boosters do you need to avoid any symptomatic disease?
Right.
And the answer to that is infinite.
Infinity,
because it'll never happen.
You need a booster,
IV booster
IV drip.
Bolus. Yeah. And even then they're saying, you know, they went from 6 months to 4 months to 2 months. And now they're like, if they've withdrawn the needle from the last booster, it's okay to slide one in.
Right.
So they're, okay, so the booster, you'll never avoid that. And then what is the optimal number of boosters, shots or total doses needed to minimize severe disease and hospitalization? And it's a very open question. We don't really know. And obviously it's probably different for a 95-year-old versus a 15-year-old. But this administration doesn't seem to understand that there's a difference between the two, because they always want one-size-fits-all policies to satisfy Lord Borla. I mean, the American people, Lord Borla.
The Rings of Power Borla edition.
I will just say this. If any one of those people involved in these decisions end up on the board of director of Pfizer or Moderna—
We will make sure to point it out to the world.
Every day. And I think, I think this is one time that the American people will really be pissed.
Yeah.
Because this is all that other— All that other revolving door stuff never got this level of attention.
Yeah.
This is one that they got to be real careful.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, the last FDA commissioner, he's like on some venture capital firm that has equity in Moderna. And you know, Gottlieb is on, is the board of director of Pfizer.
Oh yeah. And he's quite open about that. I mean,
quite open.
It's fun. You know, what is also fun is watching Vinay Prasad's frontal lobe activate in real time when you're about to drop a curse word. I saw it and you were just like, and you could just see like a little electrical current right here from the frontal cortex, just right back to your limbic.
I'm just seeing if it's possible. The fan, you know, there's a subset of fans
that really want us to curse constantly.
Yes, of course. That's that. And that's the audience that I wanted.
They're my people.
But, but there's a subset that really, you know,
it is a sanctity versus degradation offense again. And I get it. I do get it. There is a certain— I used to really hate that kind of stuff, like the whole sanctity thing. Like, oh, that's right. it's beneath you. It's this, that, the other thing. But now I understand it more. The older I get,
there is
a certain
decorum.
There's a certain almost a purity sense that humans are born with. It's a kind of disgust aversion. And it's evolutionary. Like, you don't want to— you see a dead pig on the ground that's rotting with flies in it, you don't go and eat it.
Correct.
And it's the same with, like, you know, a whole bunch of F-bombs to a certain sensibility. That's almost like seeing a piece of poo on the ground and you're like,
they find it.
I was listening to this.
And you know
this.
What? I want to prove to them that, you know, I don't have to swear to make my point.
That's the thing.
And I don't have to drink to have a good time. Do you? You know? Just makes it easier.
Just makes it easier. No. I mean, I go right to the crack pipe because I find the crack pipe, it's a stimulant. It's also a relaxant.
Well, you're in the right city for that, San Francisco. Oh, I'm sure that they'll probably give you one.
I got to
say
this.
Probably give you one, like said SF Pride.
Totally. It says Mayor London Breed presents you with this. You know, when you go to the airport in some cities, they have like the mayor on this tram. It's always like, Mayor Pickles McGillicuddy of Orlando welcomes you to the center of joy in the universe. In San Francisco, it's like, yo, we got you a crack pipe, Bill.
You know, I think that although I'm, you know, obviously a big proponent of harm reduction,
yes,
even in that space,
yes,
you know, I think that San Francisco does have some policies they need to optimize.
It's getting
a
difficult.
Little
and I'll say this: when
dicey.
I rode in on the Uber to go do this talk,
oh yeah,
even my Uber driver, who was Russian, was like, "This place disgusting." Because we were driving through, coming from the suburbs, he's like, it's gotten worse. When I was here, only 3 homeless people. Now 23 and all smoking crack at once. I'm getting contact high. Just driving through in Prius.
I had a European visitor who pointed out that, you know, that the percentage of people homeless who were not wearing pants was like a— and this is somebody who's like been to cities like Paris that had a lot of homeless.
It's because of Zoom.
But even there, the pant wearing was a lot. Anyway, okay. But here's what somebody wrote to me about Paul Offit, speaking of his praises.
Yeah.
Listen to Z-Dog Paul Offit interview this morning. Wow. Paul Offit should be CDC director or perhaps have oversight over vaccine approval at FDA, the former Grover Krause position. Why? Board certified pediatric infectious disease specialist. Physician scientist. Has published numerous academic papers. Sees patients clinically, understands the basic science of immunology, understands public health, impeccable reputation among vaccine advocates, made a vaccine himself, can interpret data well, ranging from basic science to epidemiologic data, outstanding communicator, understands knowns and unknowns, willing to admit what we don't know, willing to change his mind if presented with new data, understands discussions of risks and benefits, willing to engage with people who interpret data differently than him.
You just went through the checklist of what we all ought to be looking for in every critical thinking public physician official, period. In everybody, honestly.
Let me do some of the other administrators of the
administration. Oh, please do.
Ashish Jha, board-certified pediatric infection. No, he's not. He's a Twitter pundit frequently seen on cable TV. I mean, that's how they found him. Physician scientist, I guess so. Has published numerous, yes.
Yes.
Sees patients clinically, I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe, I think he used to have a half-day internal medicine clinic at the VA, maybe? Mm. I don't know. Mm. Understands basic science of immunology? No comment. Understands public health? No comment. Has an impeccable reputation among vaccine advocates? No, he has no reputation there. Made a vaccine himself? No. Can interpret data well? No comment. Understand. Outstanding communicator. Yes, I'll give him that.
Yeah.
Understands knowns and unknowns. No, he doesn't understand unknowns.
Or he may, and he doesn't communicate it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Willing to admit what we don't know. Well, yeah. Then you've already said that. And changes his mind if presented with new data. I mean, only if Albert presents it to him. If Borla tells him, maybe, but not if the rest of us tell him, understands decisions or risk, discussions of risks and benefits, willing to engage with people who interpret data differently. No, that's the biggest problem of the administration is that they only have like a group of, they're like, we have the COVID transition panel.
That's right.
You feel free to wear your N95 or KF94. You know, it's only one type of mentality.
Yeah. They don't have, yeah, exactly. Although, you know, to their credit, I do know for a fact that they do talk to other people across the spectrum it's probably one of these deals, like which way is the wind blowing in the public. But I'll give them the benefit of the doubt that they do try to do that. I think all the people involved are good people who have reputations and so on and are probably empathic and so on. But I think there is a corrupting influence of being in an org with a group think and you're contributing to it by not cracking out of that a bit and having a more diverse panel of thinkers.
I totally agree with you. But I also think there's like a bigger point here, which is that like in the academy, how many people do we even know in the academy who ever go against the grain on anything?
Good point. You don't succeed in academy if you do that.
No. And I mean, the whole profession selects people going to medicine to be obedient, you know, like you chasing your flies, like Lord of the Flies, you know, you have to do that lab work.
That
to
was
get
uncalled
in there.
For. And also absolutely true. Yeah. Where do I sign up? I remember going lab to lab trying to get a job and having to make shit up about why I was interested in whatever their shit was.
Yeah. And the answer was, I just need to check this box off to go to medical school.
That was the answer. And you know, what was funny is my professor who ended up saying yes, was the teacher of our genetics class. And he knew right away. He's like, you just want to go to med school, don't you?
Yeah.
And I go,
you're like, no, I don't.
Oh, no, I'm really interested in genetics. And he goes, let me just pull up your final exam and see how you answered my very difficult genetics question. And what was interesting was I got lucky on that question and showed some random bit of brilliance when I was younger.
So
and he was like,
him.
Oh, this is really good thinking. I like the way you did this. All right, you can try. You're going to make fruit fly food.
They're like, why do you want to do this? And you're like, ever since Gregor Mendel. Ever since Mendel planted that smooth pea and rough pea.
Oh, man. I got all the peas. I got a Punnett square over my
and
bed.
And who's the other one? Thomas Hunt Morgan, the food fly guy?
Right. Was that him?
I forget his name.
But yeah, dude, Punnett squares.
The Punnett squares.
And the F1 generation.
And then you're like, but the thing about Drosophila that fascinates me is that so many things are X-linked. And you're like, you really threw off my Punnett square.
Yeah. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm really fascinated more with the mitochondrial genome. Mm-hmm. Is there anything involved with that? No. Oh, that's bullshit anyways.
You know, I view my life as in equilibrium, like the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. Like the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium.
You dropped the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium.
And I don't even know what that means anymore.
Dude, it's some evolutionary thing, right? With like number of species, like number of individuals in a species, and they get into equilibrium over.
I don't want to even dare offer an answer what it is, because that's how irrelevant it is to practicing medicine, because you very rarely need to know, unless perhaps you're a genetic counselor, geneticist. I think it has to do with allele frequency or something like that.
Okay. You're
going to look it up?
You're right. Because now while you're talking about, oh, dude, my new AirPods just arrived.
Oh,
I got
exciting.
A text. I'm so excited because it's got 50% more noise. Nobody gives a crap.
If I ever see you wearing those, I'm going to smack them out of your ears.
Punch me. I know how you feel about those. That's right. I forgot about that.
I mean, CNN is basically a network show where they put AirPods in somebody and then film them on Skype. That's the whole network.
It's true.
We have a new expert here.
With terrible eye contact, where they're staring at the screen. Okay, Hardy-Weinberg principle in population genetics is known as a Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium model theorem or law. States that an allele, God, you're so smart, Vinay, and genotype frequencies in a population will remain constant from generation to generation in the absence of other evolutionary influences. These include drift, mate choice, assortive mating, natural selection, of course, sexual selection, mutation. Gene flow, meiotic drive. I don't know what that is.
Well, we don't. Let's not go there right now.
Let's not go there then. Genetic hitchhiking.
Of course.
I don't know what that is. Population bottleneck. Founder effect.
Yes. Okay.
Yes. Inbreeding.
I see.
Uncle Dad. And outbreeding depression.
Oh, fascinating. Okay.
Yes. And this is just for people.
Oh, yes. Classic.
I don't have the focus.
Where's my TI-89? I'll graph that for you right now.
I saw the Commodore 64, so.
You know, the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium to me is it's like the back of my hand, see? It's just like the Krebs cycle right over here.
Right over here.
You know?
Pyruvate dehydroxygenase or whatever. I don't even know.
Isocitrate dehydrogenase.
Oh, wow.
I was like, do you want
how many ATPs or NADPH?
Do you want a few ATP?
I do.
You want a few?
I'm down with it.
I can help you there. But down with ATP? If you want more than
that, yeah, you know me.
I gotta go somewhere else.
You gotta go down the oxidative phosphorylation.
Yeah, if you want a little more.
Go down the electron chain, the electron transport chain.
It's funny that when I was in pre-med, we had to like literally they give you a blank piece of paper and it was like, today's test is to just go ahead and draw that. And I was like, yeah, the most useless thing ever.
Oh, to absolute garbage. But you know, so back to Paul. I thought that he made a compelling case, good guy, and if something changes, he'll change his mind on the bivalent booster. And he made a point of saying, it's not for, like, think about the elderly, the people with multiple comorbidities. Maybe they're a good thing to get a booster in general, because like you said, even the smallest, even reducing their chance of infection might reduce a hospitalization, even if it were a cold. Yeah. So that's fine and dandy, but painting it as all adults should get this by CDC is kind of crazy.
It's kind of crazy. And let me make a couple of arguments here. One is you pointed out the low uptake, but I just checked the statistics and it was like 4 million people have already gotten it.
Okay.
And so my argument from that is that suggests to me there are 4 million people who are rabidly eager to get this.
That's
They're
right.
very eager.
Yeah, low-hanging fruit.
Okay. I think you could, with the resources of Pfizer, and if you just told him, if you want to do this, we're going to need you to randomize 500,000 people in 2 weeks, they would do it.
They could do it.
They could do it. Albert Bourla would just say, look under his couch cushion, find 120 mil that happened to fall out of his pocket, you know, and he could do it.
Yep.
And I would say that if you're really worried about the elderly, that trial is going to result really quickly because the endpoint is going to be accruing very quickly.
Right.
And it would be useful information. And then some people argue that, you know, there's a big debate in biomedicine about like, are underpowered trials useful or bad? Sometimes they can be useful and informative. But the truth is, it's really important that somebody like Paul, as this person points out, impeccable credentials, says this because one, it gives a lot of freedom for lots of other people to talk about this issue openly.
Right.
Two, I think Paul Offit saying that really puts some of these universities in a bad place. Tufts University has already mandated it. You saw that?
He said clearly, he's like, I wouldn't mandate that. That'd be crazy. Unfair.
They are crazy.
Yeah. It's nuts.
It's really concerning in a time of, great disagreement. That a mid-level bureaucrat
can make a decision
at a mediocre institution. Sorry, no offense. No, I didn't mean that.
You know what? It's funny because we were talking.
I didn't mean that. Tough.
We were talking about institutions.
I gave a lecture there earlier.
No.
It's not a mediocre. The bureaucrat's mediocre.
That's right.
But you're great.
That's right.
You're at least the Actually, best one, program
in one part of Boston.
In one part of Boston. In the part of Boston that you're in.
But it's funny because why would they do that? Is it because of science? No. Is it because of potentially the general political bent of those academies and Tufts in particular in Boston is already a very liberal leaning place that they're just part of this kind of tribal thing where some bureaucrats like, you know what, do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's that it's a school in a blue of blue cities. And right. So blue and the branch Covidian theories, they go hand in hand.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think probably many of the faculty who called for this were saying that if you don't do this, I'm not going to teach my class. I've seen many professors say, how dare you have me go in person and risk my life and teach this class? Well, meanwhile, 1997, a teacher who taught a winter semester was risking their life. And do you know what? People risk their lives all the time for noble causes.
You go across the street.
You go across the street. You risk your life even in the commute. But I'm sure maybe 10 years from now, we'll get to the point where if you tell somebody they have to show up to work in person, you're risking their life on the commute. I don't know where we're going with this, but I'm sure it was a bunch of professors who they tightened their N95 rubber straps.
Yep.
And they were right there in the provost office saying, you need to make this happen. And it doesn't take away anything from the experience. They're saying something. It doesn't take away anything from the experience, okay? And you know what? We joke about it, but like I had in my article about the masking in the hospital, there are people who are putting masks on people who come in with suspected stroke.
Yeah, it's crazy. How are you even going to look at their facial droop?
They get a sudden face drop. You don't see it.
Okay, so
they're putting masks on elderly people who rely to talk to an elderly person who relies on looking at your
looking
lips.
Looking at your lips.
And basically now you have an older person who's literally totally cut off from communication with the doctor.
And we're doing all this in a part of the pandemic when we've kind of really have the tools to keep this from killing lots of people as it is. So you wrote an article, so Sensible Medicine.
Yes. This is Sensible Medicine. What is Sensible Medicine?
So Sensible Medicine is the new platform. You, me, Marty, John Mandrola, Adam Sifu.
You know, Christia and I mean, many people.
Many people are on our editorial board or board of directors. And the goal is to have a place where we can have actual discourse without the politics, without all the weird bias that you see in, I don't know, certain large medical news reporting organizations.
That's why we don't let you write for us, actually.
That's right.
You haven't written anything.
Well,
thanks. Make your promise. Yeah, let's get the N95. Okay.
I'm not a writer. Okay.
I see. Right. No, the spoken word.
I'm a lover, not a writer. So what was interesting is what I'm seeing now in the content that's coming out is just this beautiful diversity of thought. And some of it's like Adam Sifu writing an amazingly moving piece about what it's like to be a doctor, the art of medicine and countertransference with our patients and dealing with difficult patients. And then John Mandrola wrote about hormone replacement
Silly
therapy.
He stepped in.
Silly
it.
Man, Women's Health Initiative trial. Is that mm-hmm. it? WHI?
WHI, yeah.
No, so now this is where Sensible Medicine shines because he stepped right on the beehive.
He made a bold claim.
Yes.
And his claim was basically that we adopted the widespread use of hormone replacement therapy for women, both perimenopausal women, typically in their like 50s or maybe a little earlier, maybe a little later, and postmenopausal women, women in their 60s, on the basis of observational data that suggested protective effects of estrogen and progesterone and that sort of data. It was widely promoted by a company called Wyeth Pharmaceuticals that I think was like litigated to bits about this. Mm. Then Women's Health Initiative came out, I think 2002, 2003, 2004-ish. And it was a randomized control trial of postmenopausal women that showed no benefit of hormone therapy, but increased risks of cardiovascular disease and stroke and increased risk of breast cancer. And so it widely led to a 50% reduction in population use of this.
Right.
So it's an interesting kind of series of events. Mandrola tells this as a story, and his point is that you can't trust observational data. I think that's the gist.
Right.
Now, two really great readers read this, and they said, screw you, Mandrola. So one was a doctor of epidemiology at Harvard Medical School, mm-hmm. and this person said that what Mandrola misses is that the observational studies and the randomized trial were really asking different questions. Mm. And if you were to make an observational study ask the exact same question as a randomized study, which is that in a 63-year-old on average woman, should she continue or stop her estrogen, then the observational study actually perfectly recapitulates Women's Health Initiative. Ah. So you just didn't even do the right observational study. Ah. This is called a target trial framework. Ah. So that was the point of this gentleman.
Got it.
The second gentleman, Mr. Dave Alleli, who's like a third-year medical student in Mount Sinai, but also quite brilliant.
Yeah.
Dave Alleli says that Mandrola is wrong because he was talking about that one specific question, an older woman started, you know, continuing or stopping. But there is still a legitimate use of this. A 50-year-old perimenopausal woman taking it potentially for a short period of time for right. postmenopausal That's symptoms. Right. And he cites a Danish randomized trial that shows that that might have some efficacy.
Right.
And then my basic thoughts were one, target trial. I want to be persuaded. But recently the FDA commissioned a series of clinical questions to have both random that had randomized trials. They asked the Sebastian Schniedelweiss group at Harvard to run a target trial in each of these, and they could only replicate 50% of the randomized trials.
Wow.
So that's like as good as a coin flip.
Wow.
So that means target trial, I think, is still immature. I mean, it still has work to be done.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the second point to this gentleman, Dave Alleli's point, which I think is very good, which is that I think he might be right that it is a mistake to read WHI is an indictment of any hormone for any woman at any age.
Right.
Because no trial can show that a therapy doesn't work under any circumstances. Right. But what the burden must be is for somebody to prove in whom it works and where it works.
Right.
The Danish study, I was looking for a protocol. I didn't quite meet my threshold of, you know, what persuades me.
Right.
But I think Dave Alleli makes a good point. So then Mandrola comes back with a response. And I mean, this is, if you're into this stuff, this is like boxing, man.
Oh my God. And you put it all out there on Sensible Medicine.
Yeah. And guess what they don't say?
What?
They don't say things like, John Mandrill is a cardiologist. Yeah. Why is he talking about a women's health? He's a man. He's talking about a women's health issue. They don't say that.
Nope.
They don't say, John Mandrola never did a target trial in his life. He shouldn't be talking about this. They don't say that. They literally just focus on the
issue. On the issue. It's so brilliant, dude. Like when I get those feeds come in and I look at the articles, I'm like, this is what we ought to be doing. Like this is the what the alt middle approach to sense making is in medicine. That's why it's sensible medicine.
Sensible
so
medicine.
You can check it out on Substack, right? So what is it? Sensiblemedicine.substack.com?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Or just sensible medicine Substack. Something like that.
Something like that. Just
some
Google
permutation of the
words.
You'll find it. It's got a blue logo.
There you go.
It looks awesome.
Subscribe to it.
Subscribe to it.
Yeah. And
then also subscribe to Vinay Prasad's Observations and Thoughts, where we don't pretend to be balanced. We just tell you the truth.
Or the Z-Dog MD show, where I'm not sure what we're doing.
You're not on Substack. You're on Locals.
No, I'm on Locals. Yeah. By the way, so yeah, zdogmd.locals.com. Join us there because we have these really great conversations.
Who's going to win, Locals or Substack? I hear Locals is now doing some...
they're doing articles.
Articles.
You can do articles now. I think Substack, I don't know.
They have a founder effect, you know, to your Hardy-Weinberg right. equilibrium.
Hardy-Weinberg, yeah, there's a founder effect. I'm more in the outbreeding depression
oh, okay.
part of that.
You're the squirrel that got separated by the Grand Canyon with like two of
exactly
its...
Exactly
yeah.
right. And now I'm left to genetically drift into my own
in
feces.
Inbred.
Yeah. totally. In yeah.
In
Uncle
a,
Dad.
In
exactly.
A royal family type.
Habsburg jaw sort of deal.
Right.
Yeah. I hear
you're
you.
You're on
I
that
you.
Side of the canyon.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. But, you know,
to each their own.
I have to say that, you know, I consider myself mitochondrial Eve.
You do.
Yeah.
I see.
Being male. And,
yeah. Right. Of course, being a man.
Because now I can just stake a claim to that. I'm just saying I'm mitochondrial Eve. Yeah. But I identify as mitochondrial Eve. So sensible medicine. You wrote the thing about masks in central.
Oh yeah, and you know it got a lot of traffic. Did you know that?
Yeah,
a lot of traffic.
I look at the
analytics. Got a lot of hate click.
Yes,
hate
outrage
click.
Porn.
Outrage clicks.
Yes,
but you know what? If anyone were to actually, and I got a lot of feedback. Like, at least in social. Actually, no, there was no real feedback though. Substantive. There was the best feedback, which was that everything Dr. Prasad is advocating for in this article has already been implemented and works just fine in the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
Which is like, okay, so right. What was my article? My article was, this is the fall of 2022, last day we forgot.
Yes.
And we've had vaccines for almost 2 years now.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting up to 2 years. And we need to eliminate, we've eliminated masking in like in all of America.
Mm.
I mean, there's only these tiny pockets.
Yeah.
The gate, it's SFO terminal.
That's right.
You know, the train in Italy, but when it crosses the Swiss border, the pocket ends, right? There are these pockets where people do it, but many people are not doing it. Most people are not doing it. Texas, I don't think you're allowed. I don't know if you're allowed to do it or not.
You get shot.
You get shot. But we still do it in the hospitals. And we don't just do it in the room for the person who known to have COVID. We do it in the gift shop, in the lobby.
Yes, at the nurse's station.
In the nursing station. And to be honest, even that varies. If you go to a hospital in Texas, they're not doing it that much. And I was walking through Chicago, a hospital lobby that feels more like a mall.
Yeah.
And ain't nobody doing it.
Yeah.
But in our hospitals in San Francisco, they do it.
Right.
And my essay was arguing that we no longer need to make it a compulsion. It no longer needs to be mandatory. If you're a healthcare provider and you're going to go take care of patients with COVID-19 in their room, the active of COVID, and you did not recently have BA5, for instance.
Right.
You know, I'm sure you're going to make the right choice.
Right.
Which is you're going to wear it. Why? Because the downside of wearing it for 15 minutes and you're going to wear a fitted N95 mask.
Yep.
It has some negative on you.
Yep.
15 minutes. And the probability you're going to avert COVID-19 infection is maybe a high single digit or double digit probability because they have a known infection.
Right.
You're going to do it there. But, you know, if you're going to see the next patient, an elderly woman who's COVID negative on entry, you've had three shots and you just had BA5 a month ago, hypothetically.
Right.
And she's hard of hearing and likes to see your face.
Right.
And she doesn't ask you to do it. And she's like stated her preferences to the nurse. Maybe we can let the patient state their preferences.
Yeah.
And then, you know, why do you have to do it? And you don't want to do it. And she doesn't want you to do it. And also, if you're in the lobby, if you're in the ABP eating your, mozzarella panini, you know, who are you helping by pulling it up between bites? And if you're the nursing station,
you're
all going to go to the Z-Dog speaking event this evening, right?
Or the Z-Dog potluck, which I ought to do. That's money right there.
Z-Dog potluck. What are you going to bring?
Oh, I'm going to bring anything that I can buy from Costco that I can pretend I cook. Like those little shrimp. Be like, oh, look what I made, guys.
Dude, people these days are so, they all know. Costco!
They know it. They know it because they all recognize it because they all go there.
And even if you have garments from Costco, they spot that a mile away. Costco!
Kirkland socks. got it.
I'm a picky on my, I only use Darn Tough Socks, Vermont. Darn Tough, the best socks. And by the way, if you mail me Darn Tough, no, they're the best socks.
Darn Tough.
Darn Tough. They're wool socks. They have a lifetime guarantee.
Oh, wow.
I swear to God, Z, I never make product placements on this show.
Yes.
You buy these socks.
Yeah.
You're not satisfied.
Darn
I'll give you your money back. They're really good socks.
Well, shit.
Once you go to these socks, you're never going to wear those other socks.
I'm starting to feel bad because I get the Puma little short socks from Costco, and I burn through them in like 6 months.
They get holes in the center of the foot. Trash.
Then I toss them out, but I mean, they're so cheap. Are these darn tough?
You're just giving employment to some sweatshop later.
You know what? But somebody, they need to work too. Those children in China need to work.
The darn tough socks, they're indestructible from regular wear and tear.
Are they too warm?
No, they come in different thicknesses.
Okay.
They come all the way from a very thin, you barely feel it on, to a sock so thick you could survive an Alaskan hike.
Like into the wild.
You could.
Wow. So that guy would have been alive with darn tough socks. That's
would have. Darn tough.
Pitch.
Vermont.
Going into the wild?
Going to the
Go in with darn tough.
I don't know if he would have survived, but his feet would still
his
be warm.
His feet would have been not black.
Not black.
Right, right.
He would have
right.
still had all the toes.
Oh, man.
I'm telling you. Do I ever recommend a product to
no,
you?
No, never. You've never.
Never. I've never recommended
You've never
a product.
Done it.
Never. I've never had anything to recommend until
That's true.
I had this sock.
That's true. I mean, I will recommend.
What are you going to recommend?
I don't want to recommend this monitor. It's too expensive. I don't want to recommend the new iPhone 14 Pro because it's trash.
It's trash.
It's fine. And I like it. But you don't need it if you have a 13.
It works in low light.
Pro.
Is that what it is?
It works in low light. It has an always-on display, which Samsung's had forever.
The Google Pixel is designed to portray darker skin tones like myself in more realistic light.
So it's 70% less racist than Apple? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm sure it's less racist than Apple. No, but yeah. It's a better... But to be honest, I think that has a better night vision camera.
It's pretty good. The camera's really impressive. The other thing I've noticed is the image stability is quite good when I do Facebook live shows in my backyard. So I like that. This for me is a business thing. Like if I don't have this, like I don't do my show.
You go out of business.
I go out of business. And then what?
But I'll tell you what, if I ever see you on an airplane with your two AirPods in watching a movie on that phone.
Oh, punch me in the
I'm
face.
I'm going to punch
I
you
won't
right
do
the,
it.
I'll punch you right in
no,
the face.
No, this is what I use my AirPods for. Nothing but noise cancellation on an air flight. It's almost like putting in earplugs.
I do put in earplugs sometimes.
Oh yeah, I used to. Yeah. The problem is then I can't turn them off easily when the woman comes by and is like, you can't smoke in the cabin. And I'm like, you can't smoke in the cabin.
I don't know why they try to talk to us on the flight.
I wish they wouldn't.
I wish they would.
Especially on Southwest.
Push a button on the seat
totally,
that says, I
totally.
Just want.
Yeah.
And you know what? The announcements?
Useless.
I mean, I was on a flight recently and they show you how to put on the life jacket. By the way, if we're in a situation where I need to reach under my seat and blow into that red tube to inflate my own life jacket.
I think I'd rather just die.
I think I'm not coming up. I'm not coming back.
That's not, yeah.
I'm not coming back, Z.
No, I don't think so.
That little whistle.
Mm-hmm.
Halfway in the Pacific Ocean.
It's like an airplane rape whistle they just have on there in case like there's a shark coming. You're like, oh my God. I don't fully understand the purpose of all that since everybody's heard it at 10
and here's how you buckle.
Yeah, here's how you buckle.
And here's how you unbuckle.
Unbuckle it.
If you've never buckled.
And of
in
course,
your
it's
life.
All in English. So like, you know, the Spanish speaker or someone else can't. Now, when you go on international flights, it's interesting because the English is always part of it. But then you get to hear like Mandarin.
Definitely. I kind of find that
and
nice.
And it's quite beautiful when you hear the Queen's Mandarin. Oh. Like you go on a Cathay Pacific flight or something, and
I've
it's like Shaoxing, Ni Hao, and it goes through the whole thing.
Oh, it's
perfect. The tones are perfect, and you're like, oh, this is the gold standard Mandarin.
And you're the expert, obviously.
I know not a word of Mandarin.
You're like you're the Mark Zuckerberg of Mandarin. But no, you get the tone, but you don't know any of the vocabulary.
I don't know
he
any
has
of
all the
vocabulary and none of the
none
tone.
Of the tones,
none of
the,
what's going on with Zuck?
I don't know.
What is going on? He's getting a lot of hate in articles on. In business things saying Zuckerberg's destroying Facebook.
So why did a guy who made like the worst product ever? I mean, I don't know what, I don't know. I don't understand the dude at all. I mean, like I've always said, let's say I make some app and let's say it's successful. And let's say you offer me $1 billion for that app.
Mm.
Sold.
Yeah.
There's no app that I'm going to hold on to build a, you know, a Carnegie Mellon corporation, you know, a Rockefeller, a Standard Oil corporation on. So I just don't understand the motivation of somebody who they think like, I don't know, does he actually believe that like he's providing societal event? I mean,
he has to have some internal delusional ability here.
Some delusion.
Or he's seeing something we don't see, which is still a possibility. Like this whole metaverse thing, maybe he sees something. I tell you, every time I put on, so Facebook sent me a free Quest 2 because I have a big
headset
and I put it on and I played with it for maybe an hour and I was like, okay, I'm bored.
I mean, I just don't understand how anyone thinks that all of these things that take us away from real in-person relationships are
a good thing.
They're not good. Everything makes life worse. I mean, here we are doing this in person And I guess technology helps because people can listen to us who aren't here.
Right.
But that's the same way television has always been and radio.
Yep.
But what makes this different is you take people and on their Friday night when they should be out with friends, they're on these stupid apps.
Yeah.
When they're at dinner and they see them looking at their phone, that's another thing that can get you punched.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Well, so it's interesting. So you would think in spirituality and like meditation and awakening in those kind of circles that there'd be a lot of suspicion about technology and saying, oh, you know, this is bad. And what I found actually is like my buddy Angelo, he says the YouTube algorithm in particular has been, it's probably led to more awakening than anything. And the reason is people start to show that they're having these experiences in their own experience and they're starting to find certain, they're starting to search things. And then the algorithm just seems to supernaturally know what to show you. So it'll show you this teacher doing this meditation, this teacher doing that. And so people really have these profound life-changing shifts. But so that's all wonderful. That's great. Then they go to an actual in-person meditation retreat and it's just a different level. And people are silent. They're not even talking to each other, but they're there in each other's presence, all with a shared intent. There's something there that is so transformative that no technology, like you can't, I don't think you'd do it in a VR. It's just not, it's not the same.
It's very interesting.
So they're complementary when you treat them like that.
Sure. But
when Zuckerberg's like, no, we're going to replace
real life
with the metaverse. And we're going to change the name to Meta.
But let me draw a distinction. Podcast, YouTube, your outgoing only, mostly outgoing video on Facebook.
Yeah.
That's one type of technological use.
Right.
But the ones that I view as very caustic are the ones where every single person on the platform feels the need to enter repeated games of interaction.
Oh.
Like Twitter.
Yeah, Twitter.
Like Instagram, where it's not just like, I mean, I do think some people use it like the way they use YouTube. They just look at like the people they want to, and you can always find a few that you want to take a look at, but, you know, inbound only. Twitter is one. And then the whole like arguing with your uncle on Facebook.
Right. Yeah. See, that's why Facebook is poisonous. I mean,
it's that repeated, letting everybody have, you know, just talk and openly and the feeling that you're talking and being humiliated in front of other people drive these people mad.
It's a bad hijack of our more primitive angels. That's what it is. And YouTube does that much less. And Facebook at its best, when I've seen Facebook work, like you curate a tribe of people and they're there for a reason and they have certain rules and understanding, then it's like, oh, they're actually contributing and we're actually going somewhere. You know, like my supporter group there is great, but the wide open page, the kind of stuff that goes down and people attacking each other, then I'll get emails, you know, your fans are attacking me. And it's like, you think I can control that? All I can do is set a tone, but people, the Facebook is what sets the tone.
Your fans, like,
yeah,
you,
yeah,
you
right,
mean
right.
like a crazy person who happened to like
happened to drop by and see something, get angry because Facebook rewards the anger with more juice and more likes and more.
Let me tell you something related to this. Recently I was talking to a colleague and this colleague was like, look, you know, I agree with you, everything that you say about like the need for randomized trials and masks and we shouldn't keep having these mandates in the absence of robust data. You're always right about that. And then he's like, and it's consistent with your prior view, which is that you like to have randomized trials before you do things. He said, the one thing I'll disagree with you about is that if an individual chooses to wear that mask, you know, that's just like choosing to wear an ugly shirt or, you know, do whatever you do. You do you, I do me. Like, that's right. Okay. And then I say, to be perfectly honest with you, like, I'm not opposed to someone choosing to do something like that.
Yeah.
But then I would say, like, what if I invited you over to my house for dinner and you come over to my house and you just see me like washing my hands over and over until my knuckles are bloody. And like, every time I touch anything, I wash my hands again.
Or every time I touch you.
Yeah. And every time I touch your hand, I wash my hands again.
Right.
And then then he's like, well, if you did that, I wouldn't be coming over to your house ever again for dinner. But then I was like, no. I was like, you know, let's say you see me doing that. You know, of course I'm entitled to do that. You're not going to say there should be a law that prevents me from doing that. Of course not.
Right.
And I'm not saying that either. But as a friend, as somebody who like cares about me, you might say something like, dude, easy. I mean, like,
yeah, are you okay?
Are you okay?
Yeah.
Like you appear to be having, and then, so who decides where it's germophobia irrational?
Right.
Versus reason. Like if I wash my hands once when I'm cooking chicken.
Yeah.
If I didn't, you'd be nervous.
I'd be
nervous too.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's something like that. And what I want to say is that when I see a healthy 20-year-old person or 12-year-old person, I'm not saying that they oughtn't wear the mask like there should be a law that prohibits them. I don't think so. I'm saying it as somebody with compassion for them, which is like for their own sake, like you need to chillax a little bit.
Right.
And I do think that if it weren't for these platforms that allow people to waste their lives in the digital space, that people wouldn't be doing it as much because they'd have to go out.
I agree. I think that's well put. It's almost like the whole cursing thing.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, yeah, am I going to come in your house and start cursing? Yeah, I'm totally able to do that. I can do that.
That's why I'll invite you over later.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that's why we're going to do it.
Yeah, right.
For you, or if I didn't curse, maybe you're mad. But the truth is, there's a certain, you worry about the person a little bit. Like you go, I wonder about their mental status. Like, are they having an anxiety sort of bout? Are they depressed? Like if you came in and you were just like, man, oh, nothing's really going right, I'd worry about you.
Or if I came in,
it's the same,
you know,
it's the same
be
thing.
Like, you okay, dude?
It's like, are you okay?
Yeah.
Especially if you're 20. And so you start to get a little concerned. Now, there was something I was going to say, and it escaped me.
I mean, Ryan, I mean, didn't you previously talked about your daughter's class, how like that they're young and healthy, oh, yeah, and they do it because it's the culture of the Bay.
It's the culture of the Bay. And that just makes me worry about the culture of anxiety that we're creating. It's this kind of social contagion. Oh, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
It goes back to this whole, you know, kind of why are we so tribalized and weird nowadays? And there are these series of quick crises. And the one is the meaning crisis. We no longer have a central mythology. Like we don't have Christianity or Islam or whatever, or even whatever. Like I actually think we should have the hero's journey as our central mythology. Like everybody, all of us are on a hero's journey, trying to grow and awaken and all of this and help each other. So we don't have meaning, so we have a meaning crisis. So we find it in these little groups. And some of the meaning, maybe this religiosity around COVID, like, oh, I feel connected. Then we don't have reality anymore because who are we even going to believe? Are we going to believe VP who says we need a randomized trial? Or are we going to believe, you know, whoever on
Albert
Bourla
who says that nine mice is one too many?
That's right. Why would you need another mouse? I don't know why I gave him an accent.
No, he does have an accent, doesn't he?
Does he?
Yeah,
he's never
accent.
Heard
he's
speak.
Like, we can't squander the mice.
Have you ever sacrificed the mouse? It's very painful, quite traumatic.
A lot of anguish.
So instead, we will sacrifice science on the altar of the mouse, the murine altar.
The murine altar.
But that's the reality crisis. Because our media is so fractured, you go spend time in digital spaces, you're just going to get the echo that you want.
Here's how I would fix the American crisis, okay? And this is going to be unpopular, but I think it, and I'm not settled on this. I'm willing to tweak it. I'm willing to experiment.
This has to do with genocide in some way, doesn't it? We're going to blow the whole country up.
I think that everyone, when they graduate high school or at the age of 18 to 19, there should be a 1 year like American service.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And here's what it should be. It's got to be like several options. You teach grade school in America, teach for America, or you do forestry work for a year, or you do military work for a year. You do something in service of this country. And here's the kicker. We're going to take people of different races, genders, regions, rural and urban, different political spectrum, and we're going to put you together. And you know what you're going to learn? You're going to learn that you actually have more in common than you have apart. You're going to learn that, you know, you don't have to always advertise every one of your political beliefs all the time to people around you who may disagree. You're going to learn that sometimes you're going to be in a room with somebody who you may disagree with gun ownership and they actually own guns and that they're still a person and they have all the stuff you have in common. And then we're going to make you watch. You're going to have to go on, you know, hang out with each other. And I think it will do a lot for people to realize that we actually have a lot in common.
Dude, that's actually freaking brilliant. I love that because it solves the third crisis, which is the belonging crisis.
The belonging crisis.
We don't know with the dissolution of community and so on. Remember, doctors had this sense of belonging in health 1.0 because we were the pillar of the community. Everyone knew us. We were trading chickens for services and so on. And now we're kind of institutionalized and commodified in an assembly line. And that sense of belonging goes away. So what do? We find our own little mini tribes and we feel like we belong. So what happened if you create the Teach for America tribe or whatever, and that's the belonging? And you got to belong with someone who has different political beliefs. And like you said, they're not just spouting them all the time because it's probably counterproductive. And then you start to question all your beliefs and go, really, it's all kind of built on a little shifting sand in the end. So kind of hold them, feel strongly about them, but hold them loosely, you know, especially when things change. I love that, man. I think that's great.
Yeah.
And it breaks through the addiction crisis too, which is the other crisis, which is that social media addiction because you're actually, people are in person. Maybe take their phones away.
Oh, that would be
when you
great.
Do that. Wouldn't that be interesting?
You should have to take their phones away.
Yeah, for like a month.
No, the whole year.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Screw their phones.
How would they communicate? Just through email, maybe.
Yeah.
Just give them a device that just does email.
Or a flip phone.
Or a flip
Boom,
phone.
Gotcha.
Oh, that's nice. So emergencies, talking to mom, all that.
Did you watch that Aziz Ansari on Netflix?
No. Sounds good already.
He has this whole like bit where he talks about like the addiction and stuff. And he's like, how did you overcome the addiction? He's like, who's here with me on Team Flip? And he pulls out his phone. And then this like last joke is something, I'm going to butcher it, but it's something like, he's like, and that's why when I got here today, I stood out there at the back door and I let him know I was here. I'm here. Something like that.
It's funny. Yeah. I saw the punchline coming, and it was still funny.
He does it like an incredibly long time.
For hours. But so it's funny. So my mom, who's 80 years old, my dad just turned 83, dude.
Wow.
It's crazy. I mean, he almost didn't make 2022 because the whole hospitalization got COVID. Just listen to this, dude. I don't even think I can tell the story publicly. It's too much. But yeah,
hold it up.
Nursing home screwed up, hospital screwed up. And, he's got three doctors in the family and it's still like a total crap show. Mm-hmm. But my mom's 80. She absolutely, my dad is like glued to this iPhone 7 that I gave him years ago. It's this big and he loves it.
It's
and
like he's a like, spaceship.
It's a spaceship. My mom would never, she had an old flip phone. Then when it died, AT&T actually forced her to upgrade to a different phone because they're like, we no longer support this 1G freaking phone that you're using. She goes into AT&T and the guy's like, oh yeah, here's the iPhone and here's the this phone and the that phone. And she just bursts into tears. My mom bursts into tears at the thing. She says, you don't understand. I'm an 80-year-old woman. I don't want to learn the iPhone. I don't want to be addicted to the iPhone. I don't want to look like these kids staring at the iPhone. I want a flip phone. I want my flip phone. If you can't give me my flip phone, just give me something that works like my flip phone. And tears are streaming down. She tells me the story afterwards. And she's like, I don't know what happened. I was just overcome. And the guy is just told, I mean, he's a good kid, he's just trying to help this old lady. So he pulls out some modern flip phone that's got many more buttons and she's like, I'll take it. And it took her like a week to learn how to use it, but she absolutely knows the danger of having complete access to all the world's information and being able to text easily. So she loves just having to, like when I text with her, I know it's gonna take 10 minutes before I get a response and it'll be three words and it'll be something about Trump, always.
it's funny, but I mean, I'm sympathetic to your mom and there are lots of things that I think that we've like butchered. So for me, the pinnacle of listening to music in the car was the CD player with knobs on all the buttons.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a big book in the back seat of like 200 discs.
Yeah, and you pull them out.
You throw the disc you want in. And now it's like, I don't know. I have to like get my phone out and get Bluetooth connected and all this stuff.
It's almost too easy.
I rent cars here and there.
Yeah.
And some of them, they don't have a volume knob. They have like that, that touch button. I'm like, yeah, I want to be driving at 65, like trying
that's
to touch them.
That's the problem with Tesla. Yeah. It's like all this crap. Yeah.
Sliding the slider.
I want analog knob.
I want
that's
a knob.
This big.
Yeah. Right. You turn the knob. And of course, where I know all the knobs are.
Yep.
And I think that's all downhill.
One of our supporters in our group is an Apple employee and has been there for a long time. And he speaks, he's a very smart guy, and he speaks very intelligently about these kind of interfaces.
Yeah.
He's like, there's a term for it. I forget what it is, where it looks like buttons.
Tactile.
There's another term for it. I forget what
Haptic,
it is.
No.
Yeah.
All right.
Either way, they think about this stuff. For cars, and Apple's making a car apparently.
Oh God!
I know,
Lord
right?
Help us.
Gonna be like the iCar 7 Plus. Oh, did you get the Max, the stretch limo edition that has the extra memory? And I mean, how's that gonna? It's gonna cost like $40,000 for like the entry level. Actually, that's cheap nowadays for cars, right? I haven't bought a car in 10 years.
I think that
11 years.
Inflation is hurting the cars. Like the car price is through the roof.
It's nuts.
Yeah, it's through the roof.
We can thank. We're almost out of time. Look at that.
We
can thank COVID response.
Yeah, I think it was the Biden capital injection and too much. That's what Larry Summers thinks. And
what about Trump's? But I mean,
Trump, I think he was sadly to say that he made mistakes, but he didn't give as much money to he didn't put the money in the way that led to the inflation. I think that is the Biden inflation stuff.
Mm.
It's because it was like a lot of late capital injection. And it was a lot of capital that was given to like average people. Whereas Trump, of course, just gave it to the rich people. But of course, the rich people
people hired more rich people.
I mean, Trump definitely screwed up giving money to rich people. But right. Biden gave too much money.
Right.
But
then you have Ukraine crisis and you have all the other stuff that's driving up supply chain stuff. And Yeah, it's we're in an interesting position.
And China's crazy. Yeah, we're in an interesting position.
Yeah, I don't know. But you know, look, either we survive this as a species and we do better and we all come together, which I think is what's going to happen. What you point at, I'm a bit of an optimist, but maybe pathologically so. What you point out with this Teach for America, like people are going to start waking up. They already do. And they realize that we don't want to fight. And we're like, this is just too much. Like we want to fight as a group against something bigger than us, mm-hmm. like, and not with each other as much. And that'll happen. And then we'll start to get a little more integral in our thinking.
I guess we have
to set an example.
I agree. And I feel like that the easiest way to get people to fight less, I think, like the political thing that they're doing, that the biggest mistake is the mandates. Like, why are they mandating?
Why are we dividing people with that?
I mean, obviously.
With no benefit.
I know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, obviously, like, if you compel someone that they're going to get fired or they get the shot that they don't want to get, they're going to be really pissed at you.
They're going to be mad. Yeah.
I know, because I'm one of those people.
That's right.
Because I wouldn't have gotten that booster.
That's right.
Which was unnecessary to me.
That's right. And again, even just the side effects of feeling like crap for a day, if there's no benefit, why would you put people through that?
And like, at a minimum, like for you to compel me to do it, you need to prove that there's a benefit to others.
To others.
Not just to me.
Yeah, right.
Otherwise, what are you going to come to my house and
don't smoke? Yeah.
And then tell me how much—
Don't eat red meat.
Chlorthalidone to take today. You know, they just keep sitting there and like make me normotensive. And then what if I don't believe in the sprint trial? They're like, oh, we're going to follow the sprint trial. And I was like, but the control arm is flawed. Mark Pfeiffer and colleagues showed in the letter to the editor. Like, take your pills, buddy. And, you know, can you imagine?
Yeah.
That's what it's like. Because I'm like, I don't believe that any of this swallowed. Well, yeah.
At that point, it's just the Cultural Revolution again. I mean, how is it different?
They humiliate us.
Yeah.
Our substack.
Humiliate you, the substack. Sensible medicine gets like—
You have to wear a big badge.
Eggs on it.
Yeah, eggs on it. Throw eggs on it.
That's right. But then it tribalizes.
There is a Cultural Revolution. It's called Twitter. It's like extremely left of center, deranged people.
It's deranged people
who are not
it's but you know it's kind of funny because remember I undid my Twitter, by the way. They took my blue check away.
No, did they?
Yeah, when I shut off Twitter for like 29 days and restarted on day 30, when I came back, I had no blue check. Mm-hmm. And I inquired through the policies and it says, oh, it's a policy that your account has to be continuously active
to keep your blue check.
And I was like, okay, so my turning it off takes the blue check away. So I reapplied for the blue check just to see what would happen.
And they don't give it to you.
And they said, you're not notable.
Oh, good.
Yeah. I was like,
this happened.
So I was notable before, but now I'm not.
I think this is a story that happened to Cornel West. He was a tenured Harvard professor. He left to go elsewhere. He came back and they wouldn't give him tenure again.
Yeah.
But he already had the tenure.
Yeah.
And so then
like,
he got pissed.
What? Yeah.
But you know, it's funny though, because I didn't see you make a stink about it, but I see every day on Twitter, so-and-so doesn't have a blue check.
Yeah, I see that all the time. You're like, oh, shut up.
I'm like, shut up.
So the point of that was, so I go back on Twitter occasionally to kind of just see what's going on, mostly to watch your tweets because they're so awesome and entertaining. And I love watching the response. And so many people that I've muted it like whenever you make a tweet, my whole feed lights up with you've chosen not to listen to this person. And I'm like, boy, I've muted a lot of people who really hate VP, but there's a reason for that, because they behave like you're describing, like tribal kind of lunatics. And just reading through, it's so fun to watch. It's like you can tell by the description, by what the signifiers, by what the signaling is in the description, that they're not going to like something that a video that I put out there, or someone's going to talk about me and they're going to pile on. And I know, you just know. It's like almost like they're wearing a costume that just gives it away right away. And that tells you something. It tells you that they're not thinking openly. They're totally tribalized.
Yeah, and some of them are obsessed with me or you personally.
Personally.
I mean, half their feed is us.
Totally. It's kind of funny to see.
Kind of funny. And, you know, to be honest.
Because I'm like, my wife doesn't think about me that much. You know, like, come on.
They're like, really? You know, it's sad. I mean, I can't imagine. I don't think about anyone that much.
Yeah, I don't.
But I mean, I think that's what Trump does to a lot of people, though. Like, people, their whole lives become. Yeah, I mean, there's to some degree, they're so obsessed with him.
I've heard people that I really admire, that are friends of mine, that are really, you know, and they say, I just get violently angry when I think about Trump. I want to, like, I hope something bad happens to him, like this kind of thing. And you're like, wow, man, you really let them get under
your
skin.
Like, he gets under your skin. Yeah. I mean, I think if, like, there are many of his policies I disagreed with.
Sure.
Many of his policies. And some of those I think are really egregious, particularly what they did to the migrant kids and the families.
Right, right, right.
Terrible. And I think maybe borderline human rights violation kind of stuff. And there are many of his policies I disagree with because I think they're a bad direction. And, but you know, but half the things he said and did, I'm just like, this is a guy who is just talking.
Yeah.
And like, he has no filter and he's just saying things. And I never got bothered. Like,
yeah, it doesn't bother me.
Who cares? He's just, I mean, in fact, the more it bothers you, that's his superpower.
That's his superpower. He knows how to trigger you. Yeah.
His superpower is isn't he more discussed than Biden?
Totally.
I hear his name more.
Even all the time.
He's like the most discussed man of the century.
When have you ever heard about a president 2 years after an election, did you hear about George H.W. Bush talking around all the time, like during Clinton?
And then he's like, I don't know, they're covering that, like, he's like, the FBI agents, those files were neatly in boxes and they strew them about to take their photos. And then people are like, you know, and then there's all this discussion about whether or not they staged the photo. And I'm like, Jesus, he's got you wrapped around his finger. Yeah. You're talking about
him all the time.
And you're talking about it. And I like, I think it's kind of like, I mean, if you think about it, it's kind of funny that they come and they take the boxes out there, they just leave it all around and take all the photos. And he's upset most that they just like made him look like a mess.
Hey man, they're doing it for the gram, you know?
For the gram. I mean, he's unintentionally funny sometimes.
He's, you know, Marty has said, because Marty has met with Trump, he's met with Obama, he's met with all these people. Because Marty, he's pushing for price transparency and real reform in medicine. Mm-hmm. And he said Trump was freaking hilarious. Like when he would talk to Trump, he would make jokes and it was actually funny. It wasn't like, I'm laughing because it's the president.
Right.
But then again, Marty's sense of humor.
Yeah.
Marty. We need to worry about this. Are there bones in this fish, ma'am?
This soup is too warm.
I think we did a thing, dude.
Yeah. All right. Good to see you.
Good to see you as always.
What is episode this? 26, 27?
Oh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we might be at 25 or 26. Yeah. Either way, I'll look it up and put it in the title.
Oh, maybe that's one thing listeners should do. If you're watching the video feed, you should go to the iTunes store on your phone and subscribe to VPZD.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I'll put a link in the comments. I'll pin it. And that way people will be able to go direct to iTunes and sign up, and the other platforms can suck it, but iTunes at least. And leave a review. It helps too, even if it's a bad review.
Yeah. I'd like to see
it. Helps us. So if you're there to like leave a bad review and you're like, oh, we taught them, it won't, it'll just help us. So,
but I would like to even read it if they're specific.
If they're specific, but they're not. They're usually like, these two vaccine shills need to, and it's like.
Yeah. And it's like, so half them say he's a shill and half is he's a denier.
Denier,
like,
oh, right. Yeah. Either way, we win.
One way or the other.
Either way, the virtue signaling is done. Sensiblemedicine.substack.com, maybe
something like that.
Sign up, just subscribe. And it's no harm, no foul. And then you get on our email list and we can bombard you with science, data, and rationality. And something that'll trigger you probably. And then you can come right like those guys did. And then maybe we incorporate.
Look how different those guys are than the people who wrote back to John, than the Twitter people.
Totally.
Oh, like these are people who know how to form sentences into thoughts and actually see where they agree and where they disagree.
That's right. And they don't have a profile picture with 14 N95 masks stacked.
Oh, we didn't even talk about that one thing I wanted to tell you about.
What was that?
Oh, there's somebody who, like, throughout the pandemic, they've been a big proponent of lockdown, school shutdown, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
And then they tweeted something like they were undergoing a procedure. I won't say something, a medical procedure. And it's an uncomfortable medical procedure. And they were going to the procedure. And then the doctor was like, if you lower your N95 for a minute, we can put the nasal cannula so we can give you the sedation. And this person was like, if I have to lower my N95, I'd rather do this unsedate.
Oh my gosh.
And then people were like, yeah, because it breaks the seal. I was like, dude, they're putting a nasal cannula. It's positive pressure. It'll blow out the air. I'm like, if you are so, you're so worried, you're going to get like, I mean, where does it stop? What if you need to have open heart surgery?
This is a DSM-5 diagnosis. This is a DSM-5 diagnosis.
Your anxiety is affecting
so
your
high.
Life.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's affecting the lives. This is another piece I wrote on my Substack. It affects the lives of the others. There are children in this country whose schools are closed
because somebody
has
a
DSM-level
anxiety disorder, which should be the cause for compassion.
Yes, and treatment.
And treatment,
but not public policy.
Public policy,
yeah.
Exactly. Dude, that's a great way to end
it. All right.
Now we've done it, and we're out. Peace.